Accession number 28735, reel 13.
Rickman, reel 13. So you're just about to tell me the next raid being Palembang.
During their occupation of Southeast Asia, the Japanese forces relied heavily on the twin refineries at Palembang, which supplied half their oil and three quarters of their aviation spirit. Now, Admiral Nimitz had asked for these to be put out of action, and because dive bombing was considered more accurate than other methods, the fleet air arm was given the job. So a few days later, our CO summoned us to the briefing room, when we saw there a superbly detailed model of these two refineries. There were, I think, 20 of us there, near enough pilots and observers. However, he said, the CO, this gentleman is our target, and our job is to flatten it, which will probably take two strikes at least, because you'll see there are two refineries. Your job is to study this model daily until you know it backwards, and you have about 2 weeks. Two intelligence officers then briefed us. They said they did not know whether the Japs had radar yet, but there were Horn locator sites along the coast, and a balloon barrage was very likely, plus a heavy AA defence. So, on the 25th of January 1945, 45 Avengers from the four carriers and 60 fighters took off at first light to fly the 200 miles over Sumatra to Plajo, which was the largest oil refinery in Southeast Asia, Shell Mex, I think. In spite of heavy flak and 30 balloons which were flying, we dived in our Avengers from 12,000 feet, bombed from well below balloon height, and returned to the fleet. 3 days later, Admiral Vian came aboard. He's the flag admiral in charge of the whole fleet. Admiral Vian comes aboard and talks to us. He says, Plajo has been extensively damaged and is considered out of action. That left the adjoining refinery, Sun Yu Gerong, which we were to attack each dawn every day until that too was destroyed. Unfortunately, the next 3 days proved impossible to fly. So it wasn't until 4 or 5 days later that we took off again, and our particular pinpoint target, the pump house which brought the oil up, if you took that out, it didn't matter how much they got left in the tanks, no more was going to come up. In order to obtain better photographic evidence of the coming attack, our senior observer, Lieutenant Ed Jess, had an opening made in the port side of his Avenger, fitted with a makeshift safety belt, a long one, so that he could lead out immediately after the attack with a hand camera and photograph the result. Because it was difficult, of course, to, with all the smoke and stuff that was around, difficult to get to know exactly what you had done and how much damage and so on. I never saw those photographs, but they may well have contributed to the final evaluation. Later, our Lieutenant Commander Main Price, Charlie as we called him, briefed us, and he said very calmly, as he always did, I have to tell you that I consider this to be a suicide mission. I asked the Admiral, I've been over in a pinnace to see him, I asked the Admiral to send the fighters in first to shoot the balloons down, but he refused, because he said it would tell the Japs we were coming. I believe they will know that anyway, because there's no other worthwhile target in the area. He also suggested that we might bomb from above balloon height, which was 6,000 feet. But he said, the CO said, but I believe that that would result in inaccurate bombing. So I said that 854 would follow its normal procedure and dive vertically, releasing at 1,000 feet. The number of aircraft needed for this strike means, he went on, that five of us who flew on the Plagio job will have to fly again. Naturally, I shall go, as will the senior pilot, and I would like Lieutenant Davis and Sub-Lieutenants Rickman and Twemlow to fly as well. Finally, I consider this strike to be so dangerous that if anyone would prefer not to fly, I shall respect his wishes, shall not repeat not think any the less of him for doing so. I could hardly believe my ears. Senior naval officer telling me I need not go if I, you know, didn't want to opt out. Nobody spoke. Right, thank you, gentlemen, said the CO. Tomorrow morning, then. At dawn the next day, in tight formation, very tight, we approached Sunyi Gerong at 12,000 feet. And the CO called, as he always did, line astern, go. We are a formation of six, having one particular target. We all dropped back to 100-yard intervals. I heard my gunner's Browning chattering and stop. The gunner comes on the intercom. There's an Oscar on our tail, Skip, but my gun's jammed. I was about to say, unjam it, you bloody fool, and I changed my mind. I said, don't worry, I'm going down now, it won't matter. And I put the Avenger into a vertical dive, and ahead of me, from this 12,000 position, I could see three Avengers ahead of me, then the balloons, some of them, and below them, yes, there was the pump house, very small, but between it, between us and our target, I could see a balloon cable, and I thought Charlie would go round it, of course, but he didn't. To my horror, he hit it, shearing off most of his port wing, just like a hot knife through butter. And then going into a vicious one-wing spin, which is not regular and gentle, but forceful and erratic. And blow it, he was only at 1,000 feet or more when this hit, and so he blew up in front of my eyes when he hit the ground. The second Avenger rounded the cable and made its attack. That's a senior pilot. And then next, just ahead of me, was Roland Armstrong, another 854 pilot. And I couldn't believe my eyes when he hit the same cable as the CO with exactly the same result. I felt sick and angry. Why the hell didn't they see that cable? I was petrified in a sense. My mind couldn't work, but I had to jerk myself back to reality because I hadn't bombed yet. And I thought, time to bomb, crumbs, yeah, there's a cable, jinked round the cable and pressed the bomb button. And at about 300 miles an hour, it started to pull up. As I got level, I suddenly found myself looking at a black wall of cloud from the burning oil tanks with jets, gouts of flame in it all the time. And I was so close to it, I couldn't do anything but go straight into it. It seemed a good idea at the time, so I thought it might avoid flak. But the turbulence from that burning oil was so violent that the stick was whipped out of my hand, and the 7-ton Avenger was tossed around like a cork. All my navigator's equipment went flying around on the floor, a wet accumulator back underneath by the tail had fallen over, and its acid had nearly reached the aircraft's self-destruct device. when we emerged from the smoke on our side at about 500 feet, I think, I grabbed a stick, got the aircraft level, and went down to treetop height and headed for the coast where we had to rendezvous out at sea, blasting away with my two front guns at anything that I saw worth firing at, lorries, houses, whatever. And I started to climb, of course, eventually. Left the coast, was beginning to climb out to sea, and looking back and around, as you always have to keep your eyes open for fighters, I saw another Avenger back down beside me, much, much lower, on the same course as me, but much lower, which I thought was okay. It seemed all right. It wasn't trailing smoke, and it wasn't doing anything. It wasn't on fire, but I realised it was in a shallow dive. Presumably the pilot had been killed or wounded, and it blew up as it hit the sea. Woof, just like that. So three in 2 minutes, you know. Jeepers. I reached down for my water bottle, which is normally full of lime juice, just on the floor below my cockpit, and I'd always kept it there, but it wasn't there. I used it on our way out to the smoke clouds. I knew, as on our way out to the target, I knew that it was there because I used it, and therefore it must have gone out through the cockpit when we were tossed about, you see, by the turbulence. The result of the attack, which was evaluated by whoever's job it was, I don't know who, 18 direct hits on our particular target. Now, we did not need to return to Palembang. Many times since that fateful attack, I've wondered how it was that both our CO and Armstrong had failed to see that balloon cable. And I've come to the likely conclusion that in diving almost vertically with your eyes glued to the target on the ground, you don't see a balloon cable which is coming, as it were, above your head. And they'd failed to look, and consequently were killed as a result. Now, it was so ironic that in view of the CO calling the proposed attack suicidal, and in spite of his request to have the balloon shot down, he himself should have fallen victim to what I and others in the squadron still consider a major blunder by the Admiral and his advisers. Had he lived, Lieutenant Commander Mainprice would have been awarded a DSO, and which, in our opinion, he would have thoroughly deserved, instead of which that was given to the senior pilot, Gerry Connolly, luck of the Irish. The CO and his crew received a posthumous mention in dispatches, because that's the only one you can get posthumously, except a Victoria Cross. Course. War, like life, can sometimes be grossly unfair. And I've added an epilogue, I would wish to say, at one of our in Devon recent Burma Star parades, a member from another branch, I must add, looked at my fleet air arm cap and said sardonically, "Fleet air arm in Burma, pull the other one, mate." I think I smiled and then replied, "I've only one word to say to you, my friends, but I doubt whether you'll understand it. Palembang."
Were the threats when you attacked Palembang? You mentioned obviously the balloons, but what was the anti-aircraft fire like? And you also mentioned that you were trailed by a fighter at one stage. So was it a combination of all those elements? A
combination of all of them. You see, the Oscar that was on our tail, whether my gunner hit him, whether he was a trainee pilot and tried to shoot and failed to hit me, or whether he was so surprised at finding that there was a gun turret facing backwards, I'll never know. He just zoomed away and I went down. We just separated. No. The flak itself, I didn't have time to realise. I didn't see any on our way coming up to the target. There must have been some, I guess, but I don't. Were we? I honestly don't know whether we were the first squadron to bomb, or the second, or the third, or the fourth. There were bombers from all four carriers, of course, there. And they were all had different targets, of course, you see, that was the thing, yeah. And even us, we were flying 12 aircraft and we were in 260. I don't even know what the other six of our squadron were bombing. You just know your job, your details, and the outskirts of it and so on, and you keep within them. So, don't know is the answer, I'm afraid.
And what about the target? Because you said it was a pumping station. You said it was quite a small target. What could you see when you made your dive?
I could only see the roof of some sort of building getting slightly bigger as I was coming down at 1,000 feet and thinking, you know, having seen the other two crash, yeah. There it is, yeah. Bump, pull out, level out and get the hell out of here now.
And apart from the casualties you mentioned during that raid, had you lost anybody on the first raid at all from the squad?
No. No. We can come on to another one. Not immediately. I'll go, if you finish with Pal and Bang, I'll go on to something else, yeah. When we left Pal and Bang, we thought that we were going back to Trincomalee, but we suddenly set a course southeastwards from Sumatra, and that wasn't going to take us to Ceylon. We were in fact going for Australia, and that was what we're saying.
You're heading for Australia.
Yes, we went down south on a southerly course and got to Fremantle, which is West Australia, of course, where I had relations. But when the ship, our ship, Illustrious, went in close to dock, all the other fleet stayed out, and the captain came on the blower and said, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but no one's allowed ashore. We are only here because we are short of oil, and therefore we are taking on oil for 3 hours. No one, I repeat, is allowed ashore. I summoned my courage, such as I've got left, and went to the captain and said, please, sir, could I go ashore? You heard the pipe, Rickman. I said, yes, sir, but I have family in Perth, uncles and aunts that I've never seen and probably never will. I don't know. This is the only chance I think I might have of seeing them. And being Captain Lamb, he said, all right, Rickman, you have 2 hours. God help you if you're adrift. I said, aye, aye, sir, thank you very much, sir. And I shot down the ship to the dock, grabbed a telephone in the cafe, phoned the university where I knew one of my uncles worked. I didn't know what he did and what his name was. I knew it was Uncle Frank Rickman. And fortunately, he was obtained and came down in the car, picked me up and took me back. And I met cousins there that I've never seen, some of which I've never seen since. Had a very pleasant tea party. Two little cousins in brownie uniform. I had a direct cousin there called Douglas, who I saw later on television, on British television, some a few years ago, but that's a different story. However, at one point during this short family meeting, I was asked when I last saw an orange, and I said, I can't remember. You haven't had an orange for years? I said, that's right, yeah. And Doug said, turn round and open the window behind you, pick one off a tree. Which I did, and never forgot it, no. And went back on the ship anyway. And we went round south of Australia, across the Great Bight to Bass Strait, which is a bit between Tasmania and Australia. When we got there, CO, a new CO, well, it was a Lieutenant Jess, the senior lieutenant in the squadron, said, "Ricky, I've been told to fly off 9 Avengers to go up to Nowra. That's a naval air station just below Sydney. So we're going to catapult you off one at a time. No need to dress up, no need to take any ties and things or anything. Be totally informal. You won't necessarily have anyone in the plane with you. I might send a mechanic, but 9. And Lieutenant Davis will lead." So 9 of us got catapulted off in the Bass Strait. Bad weather, low cloud. And we, rough V formation, and we flew up the southeast coast of Australia at about 500 feet in the rain. And all going well and straightforward, we get, I suppose, 40 miles, 50 miles maybe. It's about 100 plus to Nowra, 130, something like that. No. We get less than halfway anyway. And the cloud base has gone down to 300 feet and we're flying at 200. And the Lieutenant Di Davis, who's leading us, suddenly calls up and says, "I think the weather's getting worse, chaps. I see out to port there's a what appears to be a deserted aerodrome. We're going to land there. So lie astern, follow me." And we land. It's deserted, there's no personnel, there are no tarmac runways, they're red dirt runways, 3 of them. And we all taxied our Avengers up into a line and parked them beside one of the runways and looked around and couldn't see anything. No buildings, no hangars, no control tower, nobody. Only a kangaroo that hops out of a bush nearby, stops and looks at us, and hops away again. It's the only time I've ever seen a kangaroo. I don't know. "What are we going to do?" "I don't know," said Di. We'll have to make contact somehow or other. And someone said, "Hey, look. See that tiny little hut over there? There's a chap on a bike. He just got on it. He's coming over." So sure enough, we all look, and there's this chap on a bike, and he gets closer to us, and he's got a wide-brimmed hat and so on, as many Australians do, and his shirt and trousers. Not very commandingly dressed, but... He stops his bike and gets off and says, "Chief, where the cup of that?" We said, "Terribly sorry, didn't quite catch that." "No. I said, "Chief, where the cup of that?" And I said, look, old chap, you're speaking rather too fast. Could you mind saying that slowly?" And he said, "Oh, jeez. I said, do you fellows want to come to a dance tonight?" And we said, "What the hell are you talking about?" He said, "Well, the girls on the telephone exchange in Maruya, that's a little town just over there, they saw you circling, so they knew someone's coming, so they lay on a hop. All right, yeah? Do you want to come? If you're staying, that is." We said, "Oh, yeah, we're staying, yeah." So we stayed. It was a barn dance. There wasn't a foxtrot or waltz in sight. And I've got great big flying boots on. However, we were very well looked after by them. And various people offered to put us up for the night and so on. I slept in the upstairs patio, as it were, a pub, local pub, which was open from 12 till 8. What am I talking about? 8 till 5. 8 in the morning till 5 in the evening when it closed. And next morning we were driven in a lorry back down to the airfield where the Avengers were. And out of the 9, only 4 would start. So Di said, "Well, mine started, Ricky. Look, you're senior sub-lieutenant. Stay here in charge. Hopefully the people will put you up, because we haven't got any cash or anything, you see. And I will send some batteries down by road from Nowra in as soon as I can. It took four or five days, actually. Anyway, when it when the batteries came, we all went down again to the airfield, plus the friends that had been made during the stay. And one of the pilots came up to me just when we were about to climb in and said, "Look, Rick, I've been staying with a very friendly family, and they've been so kind to me. I sort of half promised the daughter of the family that I'd take her up for a quick flip round in the Avenger. Is that all right?" And I said, "You know bloody well that's not right. That's against Admiralty instructions and King's regulations. But all right, yeah, one circuit only, okay?" "Right," he said. He told the others. And then there were grannies, there were uncles, there were 10-year-old kids, there were little daughters. It seemed half of Maria came up with us. We all did two circuits and landed. And after we landed and all our passengers disembarked, I said to the chaps, "Right, I'm taking off now. Follow me 100-yard intervals behind." And I took off in the Avenger. And I waited till we all got airborne and we were circling around the place. And I said, "Right, set your radio altimeter to 6 feet. That means we're going to fly 6 feet off the ground." I looked at the main street in Maruyu, and it was a nice wide one. The houses were all set back and only on one side, although they were double story. There were telegraph poles on the other side, but they were set back too, so we could get down the main street. There wasn't a car in sight, not a pedestrian even. So I thought, right, this is where we say goodbye to Maruyu. And I dived down with my Bombay U 6 feet off the ground and flew along the high street, the main road of Maruyu, I suppose at something like 130 miles an hour, and the other Avengers behind me. And I was waving up to people who were on their upstairs balconies, thumbs up sort of thing, out of the way. Now, the story ended there in a sense, but you see, 40, 50 years later, I decided to make a model Avenger. I wanted to do a painting of one at a certain angle. I thought an Airfix model would be a good idea. And it was only when I was making that I discovered that the propeller is 2 feet 6 lower than the Bombay. That takes us on to the Pacific and the Sakishimas. We met the Americans. We, the task force, left Sydney it was certainly after Christmas, well after Christmas, yeah. It doesn't matter. We were to join the Americans. We were task force 57. And our job, this was on the Okinawa landings, as it were, when that was being assaulted by American troops. Just south of Okinawa were three islands, the Sakishimas, which were the housing, the kamikaze pilots and their aircraft and so on. Nimitz wanted those three obliterated every day, the runways bombed, holes and shelled, and insulations destroyed, planes shot up on the ground, as much damage as we could do, stop them from fighting the Americans who were assaulting Okinawa itself. So we did an attack on Hirara. We did two strikes. One was my birthday, that's right, that's the first one. So it's March the 26th. And we climbed in the aircraft, we start up the engine, we're all ready to go. And Johnny behind me calls me up on the intercom and says, "Rick, have you looked out the starboard?" And I said, "No." He said, "Just do so. This is first light, remember." I look out the starboard. There's the dark sea, there's the sun just peeping up over the horizon, a scattering of clouds alto cumulus, one here, one there, one there, a bit like a train of clouds, as it were, which caused the sun's rays to go up like this in brilliant orange and so on, just like the Japanese flag. A celestial Japanese ensign, you see.